Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Childhood obesity has tripled since 1980. It's an alarming trajectory with serious consequences and a troubling breakdown along racial and economic lines. Doctors worry about soaring rates of type 2 diabetes. Health economists worry that the cost of caring for these kids is going to break the bank. Most parents don't seem to be worried. This hour on Point, the childhood obesity epidemic in America and why our kids are packing on the pounds. You can join the conversation. Are you dealing with this in your own family? What can be done to downsize America's super-sized appetites? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Kelly Brownell. He's co-founder and director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University, which works to improve diet, prevent obesity, and reduce weight stigma. Dr. Brownell is also a professor of psychology, epidemiology, and public health at Yale. Kelly Brownell, welcome back to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Also joining me from Cleveland, Ohio, is Dr. Christine Carter Kent. She is a pediatric gastroenterologist and directs the Pediatric Cardiology and Metabolic Clinic at the Cleveland Clinic, where she addresses obesity-related disorders. Christine Carter Kent, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
Dr. Brownell, begin by describing the scope of this problem of childhood obesity.
Well, obesity is sweeping the United States. You mentioned that about a third of children are overweight or obese. It's two-thirds of adults. And we were hoping that with all the attention paid to the problem in the past decade or so, that the numbers would start to level off. But a report just came out from the Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation suggesting that the numbers, at least in some parts of the country, are continuing to grow. And in addition to the healthcare costs that you mentioned and the medical complications, there's also a very dear human cost that gets paid when people become overweight because of the social bias and stigma that they face, job discrimination and the like. So there's a lot to be said for preventing this problem.
Dr. Christine Carter-Kent, what are you seeing as a pediatric gastroenterologist in your practice as it relates to childhood obesity?
Well, not only do we see the obesity epidemic on a daily basis here in Cleveland, but in the clinic that I run, we are seeing soaring rates of these comorbidities that are related to childhood obesity. We see anything from type 2 diabetes, as you already mentioned, but also insulin resistance as a precursor to diabetes. We see patients coming in with various forms of dyslipidemia and high cholesterol, as well as fatty liver disease and sleep apnea. So these complications are happening, and we're seeing them on a daily basis.
Well, all of this has got the attention of the White House. Last week in Washington, First Lady Michelle Obama described some ambitious objectives of the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition.
Our goal is to end the epidemic of childhood obesity in a generation. We are making this a big, huge generational goal with the notion that kids born today are going to have a different idea of what it means to be healthy so that they grow up at a healthy weight with good habits that they can then teach the generations that follow.
Dr. Brownell, with the serious problem as you outline it, is that a realistic goal to end childhood obesity within a generation?
Well, I love what the administration is doing, and this administration is taking the problem so much seriously, so much more seriously compared to the previous ones, that I think that speaks to a good future. It's a very ambitious goal, and something pretty dramatic has to change in the environment if that goal is to be reached. The fact is, American children and adults, for that matter, face terribly destructive defaults or norms. We're accustomed to large portion sizes. We let the food industry market to children and adults in about whatever way they want. Foods are priced in ways that encourage unhealthy eating. Access becomes a big issue. There's a very long list of these bad defaults that create unhealthy behavior. And it will take courage and bold action from all parts of society, including government, in order to turn these around.
Let's drill down on some of those factors, those contributing factors, as you mentioned, Dr. Brownell. Well, first among them, I mean, access to cheap, high-calorie foods is a real issue, isn't it?
If I could pick two things that the country could work on to deal with obesity, one would be the one you mentioned, the economics of food. The The sad fact is healthy food costs more than unhealthy food. It's less accessible. It's less marketed. And all these factors are the reverse of what you'd expect them to be. And the other problem that I would work on would be food marketing. It's a terribly destructive practice. It's something that's been shown in robust science to affect children in a very negative way. So something has to be done about this. But in order to change these food defaults, one has to engage in combat, essentially, with the food industry in order to turn these around. You can hope the industry would do it on their own, but the evidence of that is not very promising so far.
I'm seeing the FTC reported McDonald's spending $360 million on toys to market children's meals recently. I'm seeing another report in USA Today that kids think snacks taste better when popular cartoon characters such as Shrek or Dora the Explorer are plastered on the packages in grocery stores, et cetera. Dr. Carter-Ken, does that pretty much comply with what you see in your office?
I definitely think we see this. So a huge portion of the problem is really educating parents about which foods are nutritious. I think as pediatricians, sometimes we think that's obvious, but it's not always obvious to parents. So letting them know that food items such as fruit snacks, sugar-containing beverages, that just because they have cartoon characters and their kids are asking for these things, that they need to be at least limited and most likely eliminated from the diet. I think that nutritional counseling is an important part of those pediatric visits when parents come in, and there has to be some way for us to work that in.
What do you say to parents? I mean, as a parent of two small children myself, I ask this question with sensitivity. I mean, how much responsibility rests on the shoulders of parents who cave into their kids with regard to food choices? You know, well, my kid will only eat pasta or pizza or sugary cereal, so that's what I feed him. I mean, how do you deal with parents who come into your office with overweight kids who say those things?
You know, I think it's a very sensitive issue, and you never want to put a parent on the defensive and make them feel like they're doing a bad job. And at the same time, I have two young children who ask me for the same food items, so I definitely sympathize with that. I definitely try to present to the parents that at this point, we really want them to introduce those foods to their children, and the more often they expose them and offer them, even if they at first take them in only small amounts, they'll get used to them and they'll like them more. And again, you know, for younger children, the children are only going to eat what you bring into the home, so really, really stress that don't make these foods ready available to them. The kid shouldn't be able to go into the refrigerator and pick these items. If they're in the home, they should be inaccessible to the kids so that they can't go back and back to the refrigerator and to the pantry.
Dr. Brunel, there's a deeper story here beyond what we've talked about already, that obesity rates run along racial and socioeconomic lines as well, don't they?
They do. I hasten to say, though, that the rates of obesity are high in every segment of the population. They're the highest in the poorest people in the country and in certain racial groups. And there are a number of reasons for that. Poor access to healthy foods, neighborhoods that are unsafe, so it's hard for children to go out and play, less education, so people would know less about nutrition. There are a long list of reasons that might help explain it. But again, the rates are high in every part of society.
Michelle Obama calls it food deserts, especially in the inner city, Dr. Brunel, where kids don't have access to fresh produce or even, you know, standard grocery store. It's the bodega on the corner with the canned goods that have been on the shelf for, you know, days or weeks.
You laid out the picture perfectly, and research that we've done and others have done show that you have less access to healthy foods in these neighborhoods. When there is healthy food, it tends not to be fresh, and you have to pay more for it than you do in a suburban supermarket. So the odds are really stacked against people that live in certain geographic areas, and this becomes a problem. It also, though, raises the point about whether you can help address the obesity problem simply by giving people access to healthier foods, or whether you really have to get the unhealthy foods out of the environment somehow. And some research suggests that by adding in healthy foods, you're just piling on more calories, that good calories, to be sure, but still piling on calories nonetheless, because it doesn't make the unhealthy foods any less desirable or attractive, and it certainly doesn't make them taste any worse. So that's why public policies that we're focusing on involve things like restricting marketing of unhealthy foods, and even things as as controversial as taxes on certain foods like sugar-sweetened beverages.
Mm-hmm. What about that supersizing? Speak more to that. What are the economics behind that? What's in it for a company to serve so much food? I mean, you go to some of these restaurants and it's like a trough in front of you. What is it about portion control and the economics behind that?
Well, there's a two-word answer to that, and it's called profit margin. And most of the economics of these the restaurants is such that if you people are willing to pay additional for extra food, and they're willing to pay more than it costs the restaurant to produce it. So if you go to a fast food restaurant, for example, they've already paid for the building, they pay in the personnel, they're paying for all the advertising. The incremental cost to them of offering you a lot more French fries or a much bigger drink is very small, and you're willing to pay more than that incremental cost. And so their profit margin goes up. In addition to that, the more of these foods you eat, the more overweight you become, the more food you need to sustain that weight, and you're consuming a lot of foods that could very well affect the brain in an addictive way, sugar in particular.
With 1 in 3 American children either overweight or obese, Dr. Carter Kent, what is the line between those two, between being overweight and obesity?
So in pediatrics, we define obesity a couple of different ways. The most common definition that you'll see is based upon body mass index, which is a measure of the patient's weight in kilograms and their body habitus in meters squared. And when we look at that absolute number, we then use growth percentile charts to chart them. So we look at the patient's BMI percentile based upon their age. To define someone as overweight, you must have a BMI of the 85th percentile for your age. And to define someone as obese, your BMI needs to be at the 95th percentile. And then to define a child as morbidly obese, your BMI should be at the 99th percentile or above.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about childhood obesity this hour, what it's costing us, and what can be done about it. I'm joined this hour by a terrific panel, Kelly Brownell, director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. Also with us is Dr. Christine Carter Kent, who directs the Pediatric Cardiology and Metabolic Clinic at the Cleveland Clinic. This is the American Beverage Association. They've been lobbying hard against a soda tax, and here's an advertisement from the affiliated group Americans Against Food Taxes.
Families around here are counting pennies to get through this economy. So when we hear about another tax, it gets our attention. Washington is talking about a new tax on juice drinks and soda. They say it's only pennies. Well, those pennies add up when you're trying to feed a family. Washington, if you're listening, what doesn't seem like much to you can be a lot to us.
Tell Congress, no taxes on juice drinks and sodas.
Dr. Brownell, you mentioned the soda tax in the last segment. Obviously, from that ad, there's a huge lobby involved here. Could you speak more about that and more broadly speaking, the costs of treating childhood obesity?
Well, the costs are enormous, no question about it, and that's why the country is finally paying attention to the problem. The soda tax issue is very interesting, something we've been working on for about 15 years, and it's finally jumped into the limelight, I think, for several reasons. One is people are aware of the severe consequences of obesity, and the country is willing to do something about it. And then also there's the sad fact of the bad economy, which makes states and cities need to generate revenue. So here comes the soda tax. Finally, governments are taking it seriously. We've counted 20 states or cities now that are quite serious about this. It's also happening outside the United States. What was interesting about the ad you ran is that it shows how much lobbying the soda industry is doing against this. Their lobbying was very stable for 10, 12, 15 years, and then in 2009 jumped up not by 30%, not by 50, not by 100%. It went up by a factor of 7, which shows how desperate they are to fight off this soda tax. And they're desperate enough that they're willing to embark on high-risk strategies like creating front groups like Americans Against Food Taxes. I mean, Americans is a euphemism here for the soda industry against food taxes. They're the ones who are funding it. But the tobacco industry did exactly the same thing. They set up these fake-sounding grassroots-type groups that were fronts for the industry, and then they were fighting legislative things. And when the press got aware of this and outed this fact, it really was an embarrassment to the tobacco industry. So the fact that the food industry is willing to undertake these type of desperate strategy shows me two things. One is that they consider the soda tax completely politically feasible, or else why would they have to fight it with so much might? And second, that they're worried that it would have exactly the intended consequence, that is, it would drive down population consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages. Mm.
Dr. Carter-Kent, what is the danger, medically speaking, of soda to children?
Well, we definitely worry about a couple of different medical issues. In terms of dentition, sugary beverages definitely cause some damage there. But then overall, the more sugar-sweetened beverages you take, the higher your caloric load for the day. And that really, we think, is a main factor in why children are gaining weight at such enormous rates.
You know, Jane,
and
if
then
I might
we also think about patients that are at risk for type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance, and certainly that sugar load does not help in a situation like that when patients are at risk.
Certainly. Dr. Brunell.
Jane, I was sorry to interrupt there, but there's one interesting point that can be made in addition to what Dr. Carter-Kent said. The soda industry says, why are you picking on us, that we're not the only source of calories in the American diet, and that's absolutely true. But science suggests that there's something unique about calories when they come in liquid form. That is, the body doesn't seem to recognize them very well, and you tend not to compensate for extra calories later in subsequent meals when you consume a lot of calories and sugared beverages. So the fact that many people are doing this time and time again during the day creates a big problem. Mm.
Dr. Carter-Kent, does being overweight during childhood decrease lifespan?
You know, we think that this may, in fact, be the first generations of Americans, this young group that we have right now, that may have a lower life expectancy than their parents. And we do think that's related to the comorbid diseases that can go along with obesity that I mentioned previously. And that sets these kids up to have early cardiovascular complications such as myocardial infarctions or heart attacks, strokes, and the like. So we do think that there's going to be a decreased life expectancy for these children.
Let me get some listeners into this conversation from Amesbury, Massachusetts. Ellen is on the line. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to point out that it's as a parent of a young child, it feels as though it's an uphill battle from the day the child leaves the home, whether it be for school or for daycare. We've looked at many, many different daycare settings for our son. He's an infant, from home-based care to centers. And the foods and snacks that are available are almost exclusively processed, highly processed foods. Even if they provide fresh fruits and vegetables to the main meals, it seems as though the snacks in particular are convenience foods that are highly processed. Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult as a parent if, you know, if you have to put your child in daycare outside the home, it seems very, very difficult to maintain a diet that's completely fresh fruits and vegetables and whole grains.
I empathize with what you're saying, Ellen. Dr. Brunell, how about schools and daycare, preschool settings? How important are they in the fight against obesity?
Ellen made a very, very important broad point. That is that parents do face an uphill battle because there's so many factors out there that are pushing both them and their children to eat unhealthy foods. And yes, parents can control it to some extent, but there are just so many forces that are driving this, and what's served in schools and in preschools is one of the problems. Schools around the country now are finally beginning to kick out the soft drinks and the snack foods, and that's been a big help, but it's still not happening in the majority of school districts, and we need national legislation that would really create some good standards around the country. That would help parents then. Then they could send their child to school knowing that it was a safe nutrition environment. Children go to school and parents expect it not to have unhealthy air, not to have lead paint. It's supposed to be a safe environment. Why not be a safe nutrition environment?
Dr. Carter-Kent, about Ellen's point, how do you teach a child who sometimes, you know, in preschool, daycare, sometimes is not even old enough to read? How do you teach that child to watch what he or she eats?
I think, you know, when that child is home with you is your best opportunity to do that. And, you know, I empathize with the caller. I think it's a serious issue that's happening at the school level, especially elementary and preschool. When that child is with you, though, as long as she's offering them nutritious foods, fruits, vegetables, and are not laden with fat and sugar, that she's still setting up a good model. You know, modeling also family meal times at home, sitting down, having smaller portion sizes, are all the things that parents need to be teaching their children. Now, that being said, I think that a lot of what's going on in school and preschools are going to be handled at the government level. Here in Ohio, there was just a bill passed called Healthy Choices for Healthy Children that's going to address the nutritious quality of the foods here in the school system. And I think with parents working at home and our state senate and this bill passed here in Ohio, hopefully we'll make some headway and we'll see that across the country as well.
Here's Fred in Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Fred. Welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi.
Great to hear the program. I have a couple young children myself, and we do the best we can on keeping them away from sugars and that kind of thing. We allow it at parties pretty much, but especially soda. So it's not in our house, but it is at get-togethers. I would think it would help if the soda industry was forced to put warning labels on cans, something similar to what they made the tobacco industry do, to put some warnings on these cans so that kids can understand that this stuff is bad for their body. And whether they could put aiming at the younger kids, you could put yucky faces on there, skull and crossbones, bad things. SpongeBob says no, not a good product. You know, something needs mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. warnings need to be put on these packages of bad sugars.
So something anyway, that kids can understand. It's a great point, Fred. Dr. Purnell, what do you think?
Well, I think Fred has a good mind for what's likely to happen in the future. It sounds funny to have warning labels on foods because we're not accustomed to such things. But I think the day will come soon when that sort of thing happens, that foods high in sugar, fat, and salt will have some warnings. Now, that can't be the only thing you do, of course, because the food industry can outmaneuver any government action on this front just by doing more marketing. As an example of that, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is now by far the biggest funder of work on childhood obesity. They spend $100 million a year on this problem, which sounds like a lot. But the food and it is a lot, but the food industry spends that much every year by January 4th, just marketing, just unhealthy foods, just to children. So adding things like warning labels, I think, is a good idea. I do think it'll happen, but you really have to cut back the food industry's ability to market unhealthy food to children.
What are the future costs, Dr. Brunell, if we don't pay attention to the childhood obesity epidemic?
Well, it's really stunning, not only for the U.S., but other countries as well. The current healthcare costs for obesity are estimated to be $147 billion a year, and as prevalence grows, that will grow, of course. And then as the current generation of children develop the kind of medical problems that Dr. Carter Kent described, then the healthcare costs will go up even more. And those are very significant, even in a wealthy country like the U.S. But when you talk about the rising rates of obesity in places like India and China, with such vast populations, the world burden of diseases like obesity and diabetes will be very significant. In fact, the health commissioner in China recently said that overnutrition and obesity are bigger problems in his country now than are undernutrition and starvation.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation here. Joining me from Youngsville, North Carolina, is Terry Alston, wellness coordinator for the Long Mill Public Elementary School. Welcome to On Point, Terry.
Hello, Jane. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. Would you give us a snapshot of your school? I know you have some aggressive programs there, but what were you seeing as far as overweight or obese kids at your school?
What we were seeing is we were seeing a lot of kids actually eating sugary snacks in parties or before and after school. And so this became a concern with one of our parents. And so we joined the Alliance for a Healthier Generation, and we tried to implement different types of activities or programs for our kids to help them remain active and also to teach them how to eat healthier. And one of the programs we implemented, our school is a late start, late end school, mm-hmm. and our students technically don't have to be at school until 8:45 before they're considered tardy. And they would arrive between 8 and 8:30. Well, during this time, our kids were actually just sitting in a gymnasium talking with friends or reading books. So one of our parents brought to our attention that a school in Atlanta would have their students exercising in the morning. She brought this article to me, and she asked me, could I create a program for the students for the morning time. And I told him, yes, I would love to. And we started something called Morning Moves. And with the Morning Moves, our students would come into the gymnasium, and our school is a K-5 school. We would have music playing. I would direct the students to come, for example, kindergarten through second grade would go in the center of the floor, and we would actually do dances or exercises during that time, led by the PE teacher, and the remaining students, grades 3 through 5, would be walking around the perimeters of the basketball court during that time. This became very popular with the students. It was so popular with them that they neglected to go eat breakfast during that 8:30 time, which created a problem. So with our child nutrition, the direction of our child nutrition director and our principal and our wellness council, we decided, okay, this is a problem. We've got to address this because we wanted the kids to maintain eating healthy, a healthy breakfast in the morning. So we started something called the Long Meal Cafe. And instead of the kids leaving, choosing between the gym and the cafeteria between that 8 to 8:30 time slot, they actually got a chance to exercise during the 8 to 8:30 time slot. Once they would leave the gym, we put our Long Meal Cafe right in the concession stand, right as you exit out of the gym, instead of them going to the cafeteria, and the kids were able to pick up their breakfast and go to the class and still have around 15 minutes to eat their breakfast.
And were those breakfasts healthy, Terry? This sounds so amazing. What were they eating?
They were eating, they would have a choice where they can choose either between a milk, a juice would be considered a fruit, or they could choose a fruit, such as apples or oranges in the morning. They may have toast. They may have a waffle. Those are some of the choices that they would have during that morning time.
So you believed that initially that students needed to take some responsibility for their health. You wanted to help them do that. Have you seen that happen with these kids?
Oh, yes, most definitely. The kids are steadily reminding each other. I had kids come to me that have, you know, caught on to this wave of eating healthy and exercising more, and they would ask questions, is this a healthy choice or not, because we would go over in the classrooms with them, what is a healthy alternative to Pop-Tarts? What could you have instead? And they were able to tell me fruit. Different types of fruits they could eat, or those snacks that were low in calorie, that 100% calorie. And we changed, we modified also our snack list for the school as a whole, and we gave our parents an approved snack list as to what the kids can have. And that snack list we generated from the Alliance website.
Well, terrific work. Terry Alston, I really appreciate you being with us today to tell us about it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Good luck to you. Terry Alston, health and physical education teacher and wellness coordinator for the Long Mill Elementary Public School in Youngsville, North Carolina. Dr. Carter Kent, sounds like a fantastic model for other schools. Do you see this kind of idea catching on?
I do. I think that principals, physical education teachers in our area especially are very excited about implementing these type of programs. And those are going to be choices that schools can make through that Healthy Choices for Ohio Healthy Children bill that I just spoke about. Schools can elect to participate in the program where kids have 30 minutes of activity daily in addition to gym class. But I think overall that brings up a point that we hadn't brought up thus far, that we can address nutrition, but we also need to address activity level. That's so important for these kids. In the American society, things have really shifted to a more sedentary lifestyle via computers, television, and video games. And I think addressing children's activity level is going to be key to this whole campaign as well.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the ballooning body mass index of America's kids and what 1 in 3 overweight means for the next generation of Americans. In the season premiere of the new ABC family drama, Huge, a group of overweight teenagers get sent to fat camp. Amber is the pretty girl, and Wilhelmina, played by Nikki Blonsky, is the rebel. At the kids' first camp meal, a group of girls admires Amber's determination to get thin. Wilhelmina, however, has other plans for the summer.
You're like the slowest eater I've ever seen. I chew every bite 30 times.
That's hardcore.
I've been dieting since I was 10. It's probably the thing I'm best at. I might even skip my dessert.
I'll take it.
You really think that's a good idea?
Absolutely. If I'm going to gain weight here, I need to fully commit.
We'll get to the media aspect of all of this in just a couple of minutes. I'm joined this hour by Kelly Brunell. He's director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University and professor of public health at Yale. Also with me is Dr. Christine Carter-Kent, who specializes in pediatric obesity at the Cleveland Clinic. Joining me now from North Attleboro, Massachusetts, is Teddy Bruschi's former linebacker for the New England Patriots. He's a member of the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition. Welcome, Teddy Bruschi. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us the focus of the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition.
Well, it's really the First Lady's mission. She started the Let's Move initiative, and Let's Move is about getting more nutritious food into our nation's schools and also getting education to parents and giving them the tools they need to keep their families healthy and fit, about what they feed their kids, about monitoring their kids on how long they are in front of the computer or texting their friends or playing video games on TV, about getting outside and being active. So providing parents and kids with these tools and also the food that's given to these kids in schools, trying to make it more healthy for mm-hmm. America.
Great objectives. I'm curious, as an athlete, as a role model to so many kids, Teddy Bruschi, what do you say to kids on a very practical level about what they should do to maintain good health and especially to not become overweight or obese?
Well, if I was talking to a young kid, I would try to teach him or her just active habits on how easy it is just to get outside of the house and you know, go for a walk or ride your bike or be active. Simple little exercises that can keep you fit. But more importantly, you know, they can listen to me and hear my story about you know, being a professional athlete and the things that I have put in my bodies. But it mainly comes down to the parents, because the parents decide what to feed their children. The parents help these kids make their decisions on what they're going to do with their downtime, especially in the summer now. Are they just going to be inside playing video games or go outside and be active? And what's really difficult for the parents is this, is that in today's society, it's a little bit more difficult to just say, just go outside to your kids, because there's a lot of, you know, it can be dangerous sometimes to go outside, so the parents have to do it also. They have to go outside with their kids and be active with them, and really it has to be a two-way street.
Hmm. When you're playing a sport like you have for so many years, you can eat a lot because you're burning so many calories. I'm curious if you've had to adjust your own diet and watch your own portions now that you're not playing professional football full-time.
I have. That's a great question, Jane, because I was one of those guys in the NFL where I had to constantly pump the thousands and thousands of calories to keep my weight up, because I was an undersized player in the NFL to maintain a weight that I felt kept me competitive and kept my strength up. But since retirement, it's easy to just continue those eating habits, so I've really had to curb those and make my portions smaller, and that's what, you know, I've really had great support with my wife in terms of, she knows about portions, and she's basically told me, I mean, what you eat is, you know, we've made good choices all of our lives. She was also an athlete, but the portion is really important on how much you eat, because to tell you the truth, America, I mean, the portions in America, I think when McDonald's was early in the 1950s, a soda was like 7 ounces. You can get a soda, but now they're like 22 ounces, 44 ounces. So it's easy to get caught up in this supersized culture.
Sure is, and we appreciate you helping our kids to understand that. Teddy Bruschi, former linebacker for the New England Patriots, was just appointed to the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition. Thanks for your work, Teddy, and good luck.
Thank you, Jane. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. Here's Hope from Algona, Iowa. Do I have that right, Hope? Welcome to the program.
That's right. You do have it right. Okay. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'm just glad that you guys are having this discussion this morning. And, you know, from my part, I come from a small town in Iowa where, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables and farmers markets abound, and we have nice, safe streets. You know, we don't have to worry about our kids being active or being outside with unsupervised, because we're lucky enough to be in a place where, you know, we can have our kids go around the block and that's okay. So it's not an issue of supervision or the ability to get outside or the access to fresh fruits and vegetables. My concern really is just the uphill battle as a parent, you know, against treats and snacks. I feel like, especially as parents, you know, we've just gotten into this mindset that every place we turn and every activity that we give our children, there has to be some type of food or treat that comes along with it. And so treats no longer are treats. Rather, it seems like every day someone's bringing in cupcakes to school for some sort of special occasion, or every day, you know, someone wants to bring over a plate of cookies. And that's not special anymore. It's just part of, like, regular mainstream diets where the kids are just being fed these sweet things, where maybe a generation ago it was sweet to be able to give a kid a cupcake, and now we need to be mindful that these kids have it everywhere and that they're able to eat it all the time. And so if me as a parent, if I'm able to give an activity like Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, or if there's some type of soccer practice after school, yeah, we want to hydrate and we want to make sure the kids are healthy, but, you know, if there's a thing coming that's happening right after school or right after supper, they don't need to have a snack with it. Is it possible to eliminate food from our activities so that food isn't like an activity?
The focus of everything. Now, I get it, Hope. It's a great point. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Carter Kent, are we looking at an overhaul of really the American psyche about this?
You know, I completely agree, and I could share my own example in that I have two young children that are 6 and 8, and I recall that both my children play basketball and multiple sports, and there was a game this year where my son, after his basketball game, we forgot the snacks. And I think, you know, the kids were looking around, where are my snacks? They were upset because that's so built into their psyche. So I agree that we really kind of have to change how we're handling these situations. You know, every sport, every practice doesn't need to have a snack afterwards, and if you are going to give something, it shouldn't be a sweetened juice box and a bag of cookies, maybe a piece of fruit and a glass of water. So I think, you know, those are things that we probably have to change. And certainly in my son's sport teams, we're hoping that we can address that this fall.
Dr. Brunell, speak to the media aspect of all this. At the beginning of the segment, I played the clip from the new ABC family drama, Huge, where these group of overweight teenagers go to fat camp and, you know, everything associated with that. The show's like Biggest Loser on NBC. How does that all play into the social dynamic of obesity and childhood obesity?
Well, I think the media has been helpful in some ways and not helpful in others. The news media has been terrific with respect to the way it deals with the obesity issue, because a long time ago, the media stopped writing about Dr. Jones's diet or Dr. Smith's diet or whatever it was and began talking about obesity as a public health issue and public policies and what can schools do and parents do and things like that. And that's all been very positive. The entertainment media, I think, has been less than helpful because of shows like The Biggest Loser and the one you just described. They stereotype obese people. They present them as sort of these aberrant, extreme cases of things, and they don't really provide much in the way of realistic solutions that can be helpful. Another issue about the media is the way advertising gets done. And if you look back to the point that Hope just made when she called about how the food environment has become so aberrant and there's just food everywhere. Well, the question is, why has that happened? And I think the food industry bears a lot of the responsibility. They've essentially trained us that we can eat all day long. When I was a kid, you ate 3 meals a day, maybe a snack, that was it. That's not true any longer. When I was a child, you didn't eat in the car. Now cars are designed so you can eat there. When I was a kid, hardware stores didn't have food. Drugstores didn't have aisles of food. So the food environment has become completely different. And the industry has systematically trained us to believe that we can eat anything, anywhere, any time of the day, in any amount, and that it's okay. And we're paying a very dear price for that.
You know, when I was a kid, Dr. Brunell, you mentioned how it was changed for you. I mean, for me, it was the focus on body image, and anorexia and bulimia were the issues of the day. I mean, from a clinical perspective, in a generation, the pendulum has swung so far, has it not?
It has. There was a time in the United States where undernutrition was the bigger problem, and we wanted to get as many calories into people as we could. And some policies, like putting commodity products into schools, were designed with that aim in mind. And then along came the 60s and 70s, where still obesity wasn't such a terrible problem, and people really were concerned about disordered eating and anorexia, bulimia, and things like that. But now things are really much different. The eating disorders are still a major problem, and you want to deal with them in the most sensitive way possible. But obesity far outweighs those in terms of its consequence for society. So things have changed a lot.
Let's go to another call now from Kate, who's in Rutland, Vermont. Hi, Kate. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hi. If corn wasn't subsidized, it seems like high fructose corn syrup wouldn't be so cheap. And then this is the main ingredient in a lot of foods that you're talking about as being the culprits mm-hmm. of obesity. Mm-hmm. So if we don't want cheap junk food, it seems like we should begin by not taxing it. Not by taxing it, but by taking away these subsidies. So I guess this is for Dr. Brunel. Why don't we do that? Why don't we take away those subsidies, give the money to the small-scale farmers who produce wholesome food, and then maybe tax junk food, too, and give them that money, too? It just seems like we're going about this in an interesting way.
Kate, thank you. Dr. Brunel.
Well, Kate raises a very good point and a legitimate one. And finally, the country is paying attention to agriculture subsidies and the impact that those have on diet. It makes no sense at all to have ag policy where we're promoting foods that contribute to obesity, like obesity and corn and soybeans and things where the oils get used to make fried food and you create high fructose corn syrup. And you don't really favor things like fruits and vegetables with ag policy. And that really should be changed around. Now, my economist friends tell me that it's a little more complicated than that. For example, the numbers I heard is that the cost of the high fructose corn syrup in a can of Coca-Cola or Pepsi might only be half of 1 cent. So if you took away subsidies and you increase the cost, you know, you doubled or tripled or even quadrupled the cost of high fructose corn syrup, it might go from half of 1 cent to, say, 2 cents. And that probably wouldn't appreciably change the cost of the soda. So these things need to be worked out by economists, and we need to have ag policy lined up with health policy. And there's finally talk about doing that.
Mm. Dr. Carter-Kent, what about overweight kids and depression? What does it signal to you as a practitioner when a child is overweight or obese? Are there issues of depression going into it, coming out of it, or sometimes is it just genetics?
You know what, we think that we see it both ways, that there are some children that are going to have a genetic tendency towards depression, but we also think that, you know, beyond that genetic potential for depression, that patients who are obese, they're stigmatized at school, they're teased, and they have a whole lot of other issues that they deal with, and that may bring on depression as well. And then you get into a vicious cycle where when you're depressed, what do? You eat, you gain more weight, and you become depressed again. So definitely we think that those psychological concerns need to be addressed, and we rely on our colleagues in behavioral medicine to help us address them.
Here's a call from Elizabeth in Bradford, Massachusetts. Hi, Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi. I just was calling. I am a morbidly obese woman, and it has always struck me as very odd, even as people talk about all of the comorbidity issues of obesity, that at the forefront of the discussion is not the sort of simplest issue, which is that once you are obese or are gaining weight, it's a chronic problem. I mean, there's always this assumption you can lose weight at some point later if you have an issue with it, but that's really not the case. I mean, it's like alcoholism. You sort of can cross a line that you will fight for the rest of your life.
Elizabeth, I appreciate
it. I think it's an important point.
It is, and I'm glad you called to make it. Let me turn to Dr. Brunel in our final couple of minutes here. I know Time Magazine has called you a warrior in the area of nutrition and public policy. We've talked about the food industry, some possible solutions, legislation. And what are government agencies, how are they responding, the FDA, the USDA, Health and Human Services, what are their roles, and how do you see this in a broad sense in the generation to come?
Well, before I mention that, I'd like to say that I'm very happy that Elizabeth, your last caller, did call, because it speaks to how difficult it is for people to lose weight once they've gained it. And once a person is overweight, there are all these environmental things to deal with, but also biology kicks in and resists weight loss. So it is a lot harder than just yelling at people, telling them they need to lose weight. That's why prevention becomes so important. That goes back to your issue of government. Government is really involved in this in a very constructive way at the moment, because it's not focusing so much on treating obesity, although that certainly has to be a priority, but it's on prevention and it's on government policies. And so the White House is doing very good things, and among them are bringing together the heads of all the main government agencies transportation, education, health and human services, food and drug, and you can go on and on. All these agencies are now working together to develop a concerted policy to deal with obesity. And I think this will take us a long way down the right road.
Dr. Christine Carter-Kent, how do you see this? If you'd leave us with your final thoughts on this important issue.
You know, I think the last caller, again, I want to reiterate that I'm pleased that she called and was able to share her story with us. I think as we, you know, move forward from here, I think education is the most important thing for parents, education about activity, education about nutrition. And from our perspective in medicine, what we need to do is identify the kids that may be overweight but could be healthy, but we also have to identify kids that are overweight and have what have traditionally been considered adult diseases and address those as well. But I have an optimistic look. I think this is a challenge that's at the forefront that many parts of society are focused on it, and I think that we'll be able to make some headway over the course of the next decade.
Dr. Brunell, you get the final word, your message to parents today.
Well, I do think parents can do a lot, not only to help their own children, but by being advocates. If you remember back to your guest, Terry, from North Carolina, the school person, she said that their program got started because a parent came to the school and asked for some programming to help deal with this issue. Parents can be very effective by working with their local school systems, by talking to legislators, getting after the food industry. They have a very powerful voice.
Well, many thanks to both of my guests this hour, Dr. Christine Carter-Kent, pediatric gastroenterologist who specializes in childhood obesity at the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Carter-Kent, many thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
Dr. Kelly Brownell, joining us from New Haven, Connecticut, co-founder and director of the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University, also professor of epidemiology and public health at Yale. Thank you very much for your time, Dr. Brownell.
Thank you, Jane. It's been a pleasure.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.